With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, how you can tell Smokey the Bear happy anniversary. We'll have more on that later in the show, but our top story today.
We're doing a number of things that address the issues that the special crop folks have brought to us.
Senate Agriculture Committee Chair Debbie Stabenow of Michigan says her farm bill proposal offers improvements for specialty crops, including a change to adjusted gross income, or AGI, limits for some programs.
Yes, what is considered high-value crops around specialty crops and so on, we are, in fact, raising the AGI for specialty crops. And also, we're strengthening what's called NAP.
NAP is the Non-Insured Crop Disaster Assistance Program, and it provides financial assistance to producers of non-insurable crops when they have low yields, loss of inventory, or prevented planting because of natural disasters.
We're strengthening that also because, like, if you have... you lose your trees, your orchard, or whatever. I think you can get 65% reimbursement. We're upping that to 75%.
As far as passing the farm bill, Stabenow says it takes a joint effort from a lot of angles.
We don't get a farm bill done unless it's bipartisan, period. I've been involved in 6 farm bills. This is the 3rd one I've led in the Senate, and I know how to get bills done, and I know that you do that by keeping the broad farm bill coalition together, and that means commodities and conservationists and foresters and, you know, environmentalists and nutrition folks and local governments and bioenergy, and I mean, it's all of it.
Both the Senate and House bills increase funding for the Specialty Crop Block Grant Program and maintain the funding for the Local Agriculture Market Program. The House bill maintains the National Organic Program and the Organic Certification Cost Share Program, while the Senate bill increases funding for both. Changes will soon take effect for user fees connected to USDA's efforts to protect our borders from pest and plant disease threats, Rod Bain reports.
To help support our nation's protection efforts against entry of foreign pest and disease threats, USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service collects fees from commercial shippers, whether by air, rail, truck, or ship, around our nation's points of entry. Matt Rhodes of APHIS says regarding its agricultural quarantine and inspection user fees.
The rule is scheduled now to be published in the Federal Register on May 7th, and that is a final rule. The new fees will be effective October 1st of 2024.
Rhodes adds all AQI user fee categories have been updated, with one exception.
We are delaying the effective date of one specific provision. We were removing an exemption for small aircraft that previously did not have to pay the fee. They will now have to pay the fee, but the effective date of that change is delayed another 6 months to April 1st, 2025.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. It's time for the Beltway Beef segment and an in-depth look at livestock news from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
You're listening to Beltway Beef, official commentary from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association's Washington, D.C. office.
Well, hello and welcome back to another episode of NCBA's Beltway Beef podcast. Well, we've been watching some developments on the farm bill happening in Washington, and here to provide an update is Allison Rivera, Executive Director of Government Affairs for NCBA. Allison, what's the latest on the farm bill?
So recently, we have seen some summary language come out of the House and Senate as the NCBA team has gone through some of this language. We are excited to see a lot of positives from the House legislation on the Senate side. You know, there's definitely some positives in there, as well as some items that we're going to keep a close eye on and probably have to push back on a little bit. But either way, we have seen language, and we are ready to continue to move the ball forward and continue the work. I think just getting some summary language out and knowing that the House bill is going to be beneficial for cattle producers is certainly a step in the right direction.
So as you are going through and analyzing the farm bill, what are some of those top priorities for cattle producers that you want to make sure are in that final bill?
So a lot of the priorities that we have been focused on, obviously the three-legged stool are animal health priorities that we've been talking about since the last farm bill. And even before that, we are really hopeful to see some very strong numbers as we move forward with the House farm bill. And then obviously we're going to keep a close eye on the disaster programs that we continue to unfortunately have to use across the countryside, as well as the conservation title. We obviously have a lot of priorities that fall under that Title II conservation title. And then also just reminding everyone that's listening that we really were trying hard not to have a livestock title in this farm bill. And thankfully, thus far, we see that there is no livestock title on the House or Senate side.
So remind us why it's important to not have that livestock title.
You know, it's going to be hard enough to get a farm bill across the finish line. And when you add something like a livestock title, I think you open up an extra title that's unnecessary and opens up Pandora's box to add pieces to that title that will make it even harder to get a very difficult piece of legislation across the finish line.
So next, we're looking towards May 23rd for the House Agriculture Committee to mark up this legislation. What is that markup going to look like? What should folks be expecting?
So this will really be an opportunity for both Republicans and Democrats to dive deep into the bill. More than likely, you're going to see probably more amendments offered from the Democrat side, things that they feel like they want to see in the bill that were either not included or they want to include. And so it should be a robust conversation. It is a Thursday markup. I know in the past, markups have gone, have started in the morning and gone into the wee hours of the evening, and those are always exciting for both members and staff. But it'll be interesting to see. I think, you know, there's probably going to be items, again, from both sides of the aisle that members are, that are priorities for members that they maybe want to include in the package. So it'll certainly be something worth watching.
So it feels like we've been talking about the farm bill for a long time at this point. What has the process been like to provide feedback to the House Agriculture Committee? How have producers been able to share their perspective on what they need in the next farm bill?
So just want to give huge, huge kudos to Chairman G.T. Thompson for the amount of legwork that he has done, the amount of travel that he has done across the country. But he really has just done so much outreach. He has gone to our producers, farms and ranches, and seen what they need on the ground, why they need these programs, bolstered, why we need protection in the foreign animal disease space, and has really been a huge, huge proponent for our producers, has been a huge cheerleader for cattle producers across the country, and particularly recognizes all of the needs that they have and truly wants to do right by them in this farm bill. And we recognize that, we appreciate it, and just want to, again, just give him a huge round of applause and a big thank you for all the work that he's done.
Switching gears here for a moment, I want to ask you about a new bill from Congressman Ronnie Jackson, Senator Ted Cruz, on livestock indemnity. Tell us a little bit about this bill and what it does for producers.
So essentially, unfortunately, the fires down in Texas caused a lot of death losses for, you know, unborn calves. And so, you know, these little tweaks that we see to the livestock indemnity program really can go a long way to positively help producers. And we hope to see some of this language included in the farm bill at the end of the day as well. But in this particular one creates a new payment rate, if you will, for cattle that were lost that had unborn calves. And so again, just a small tweak, but can really make a huge difference to the amount of loss and that generational loss that we've unfortunately seen down in Texas.
So where do you think that legislation might go? What is the outlook like on Capitol Hill?
So we know that there is some interest, particularly on the House side, to include that language into a farm bill. It would be in something that would fit nicely into a farm bill. It would be a great path forward. And so we hope that we can get a farm bill done soon. I'm going to continue to be a wide-eyed optimist. But again, we know that we're going to see some changes to the livestock indemnity program within this, both the House and Senate farm bills. And so hopefully we can, those two, they can come together and come to some agreement on making some positive changes to the LIT program.
And remind us, there was a farm bill extension. Where are we in that process now?
So we are still sitting in a farm bill extension, politics being what it is. You know, they will need to pass another extension if we get to September 30th, and we have not gotten further down the road in this process. But again, just want to reiterate that having a markup on the House side on May 23rd is really a step in the right direction. If we need an extension, I think Congress will provide that. And these are certainly uncertain times. And so if that's the case, NCBA will continue to move forward and continue to do the work to get a final farm bill done.
So, Allison, ahead of that markup, what can cattle producers be doing to talk to their elected officials? What should they be asking for?
So, again, I think cattle producers have done an amazing job over the last, you know, not more than a year, multiple years of just reminding our friends in Congress what needs you have in this farm bill, what tweaks you want to see with different programs like disaster programs, as well as conservation programs, and then protection from foreign animal disease. I think that coming to the Hill and storming the Hill, as we did recently with our legislative conference, that really goes a long way, hitting those individual member offices. Because just as a reminder, once this bill gets marked up through committee, both the Senate and the House, it will end up on the floor of the House and on the floor of the Senate and then in conference committee. And so every member essentially gets a touch at this bill. And it is a large package. And I think that all the work that cattle producers have done to have conversations with their members of Congress really does go a long way.
You know, there are a lot of folks in sort of farm districts who understand the needs of cattle producers in the farm bill. But if you're in a more suburban area or in a city, how should producers be approaching those conversations about why a farm bill is so important?
I love that question because food security is national security. I think you see that every single day when you turn on the news. Everyone eats, everyone has to eat, and if producers don't have the tools they need, the world doesn't eat.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for the update today.
Absolutely. Happy to join you.
This has been another episode of Beltway Beef.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
The USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service is conducting two crucial mid-year surveys, reaching out to nearly 3,000 producers in California to assess crop acreage and stock levels as of June 1st. The June Agricultural Survey and the June Area Survey help inform decisions for the 2024 crop year, aiding farmers, policymakers, researchers, and others. Producers can respond online, by phone, or mail, providing data on planted and harvested acreage, grain stocks, and livestock inventory. NAS assures confidentiality of individual responses, publishing only aggregate data. The collected information will be published in USDA reports, including the annual acreage and quarterly grain stocks reports, and will contribute to various other ag reports and USDA's monthly World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. Farmer sentiment, as measured by the Purdue University CME Group Ag Economy Barometer, plummeted in April, reaching its lowest level since June 2022. The barometer fell 15 points, with both the current condition index and the future expectations index declining significantly. The farm financial performance index dropped to 76, with fewer farmers expecting better or the same financial performance compared to last year. Short-term farmland value expectations also decreased, attributed partly to concerns about farm financial performance in 2024. However, there was a slight uptick in interest in leasing farmland for solar energy production, with 19% of respondents reporting discussions with energy companies, potentially providing support for farmland values. Overall, farmer sentiment is notably pessimistic due to financial concerns and uncertainties about future performance. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has chosen 28 organizations to host members of the Working Lands Climate Corps. The announcement's part of an effort aimed at training young leaders in conservation and climate action, offering technical training and career opportunities in climate-smart agriculture. The initiative is supported by the Inflation Reduction Act, and selected host organizations will collaborate with state and county-level Natural Resources Conservation Service staff to oversee WLCC members' climate-related work. Members will engage in activities like providing agriculture outreach, assisting in field surveys, and supporting conservation planning. The program will initially involve over 100 young people across 25 states getting hands-on experience in climate-smart agriculture practices. Training led by the National Association of Conservation Districts will cover conservation concepts and outreach strategies. NetFM recently developed a new position focused on advocacy and engagement. New Global Director of Government Relations and External Affairs for NetFM, Aubrey Betancourt, highlighted some of the most immediate areas of focus for the new position.
I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about a farm bill. There's a lot of movement back and forth on the House and the Senate that I stay mindful of. We know we're in an election year. If something cannot be negotiated here by the end of June, that's going to change a lot of the tone of the farm bill. But we're seeing drafts and summaries and more details starting to come out from both sides, you know, both parties and both houses right now. A lot of ballgame left. We're going to continue to work the farm bill because that's where a lot of these dollars that support our farmers' access to these programs, particularly in places that they don't normally access them, but also in places that they do. California, I believe, is the largest EQIP state, and it's predominantly used for this. It's predominantly used for investments in irrigation technology. So these are important things to get back to our farmers and make sure we're staying supportive in that space. But we have some things internally, you know, with the department, same thing, right? If the money's there, but the avenue or the regs are not modernized in a way to support the intention of the money or to support the intention of expanding the application of the technology, for instance, the SDIE technology, we got to be working with the agency to help them through some of their reg reviews in that process.
UC Agriculture and Natural Resources is once again seeking support for its research and extension in agriculture, natural resources, nutrition, and youth development. In its sixth year as UCANR's online giving campaign, UCANR Giving Day will run from noon on May 16th to noon the following day. UCANR Vice President Glenda Humiston said that with participation from county, program, and community leaders, hundreds of volunteers, and givers of all kinds, UCANR Giving Day shows the radical implications of a more generous world. Some of the projects funded by recent Giving Day donations include demonstration gardens, outreach teaching supplies, and youth scholarships. More information on how to support UCANR is available at donate.ucanr.edu/givingday. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Nominations are open for the Farm Dog of the Year. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The American Farm Bureau Federation's 7th annual Farm Dog of the Year contest celebrates farm dogs and the many ways they support farmers and ranchers. AFBF Vice President of Communications Terry Moore says the Farm Dog of the Year contest is important.
It's really that it provides a window into the world of agriculture through a shared love of pets. People who may know nothing about agriculture feel this instant connection through something they love.
Moore says the contest celebrates the many roles dogs play on farms and ranches across the country.
The best candidates are dogs that are truly useful on the farm, whether that's as a watchdog, a herder, or a helper to its master. We've had some pretty dramatic stories of dogs saving the lives of people and other animals, but it doesn't have to be that dramatic either. It's a dog that has a special place in the family's heart.
For more information, head to our website, agnetwest.com. The USDA has put out the latest cotton crop report. Here's Becky Summer.
The final 2023 production for all cotton is estimated at 2.1 million 480-pound bales, 17% lower than the 2022 crop. The United States yield for all cotton is estimated at 899 pounds per acre, down 54 pounds from the previous year. Final production in Georgia totaled 2.18 million bales, down 18% from the previous season. In Alabama, production totaled 730,000 bales, a decrease of 12% from 2022. In Florida, 111,000 bales were produced, 33% below last year. This is Becky Summer with the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service.
Knowing what's true and what's false about tornadoes could save your life. Gary Crawford has more.
Oh my God, this is not good. There's a whole roof that just came off.
I've never seen anything like it.
Houses are leveled.
some firsthand testimony to the power of tornadoes.
I've never seen anything like this in my 18 years covering tornadoes.
I had to hold on to the wall to keep myself safe. I didn't want to fly away in the tornado.
We had to pull a car out of the front hallway off a teacher. We even could basically feel the ground shake and like reverberations off of the power of the tornado.
We're literally taking tremendous amount of atmospheric energy and turning into a giant vacuum cleaner.
That's Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey, who says that despite our actually being able to see dramatic real-time videos of these storms, there are still an awful lot of misconceptions, I guess you would call them myths, still floating around about tornadoes.
They're about as prevalent as urban legends.
First one, some areas of geography, such as high elevations, some regions of the country, are completely protected from tornadoes. Wrong.
In the late 80s, a tornado rushed across the mountaintops in Yellowstone National Park at the 10,000-foot level. There's an area you would not expect to see tornadic activity, so mountains are not safe, river valleys are not safe. Certain areas are more climatologically favored to see tornado activity due to the lay of the land, but you don't want to ever think of yourself as completely safe from tornadoes.
And indeed, tornadoes have been reported in every state in the country. Here's another common belief.
The low pressure associated with a tornado causes buildings to explode.
But of course, that's wrong.
The low pressure in a tornado, although strong, is not enough to cause a building to explode.
Now, it's true that the winds of a strong tornado can level a house.
But not by explosion. That would be just by sheer twisting and force of the wind.
Which then explodes the next myth, that if we know a tornado's heading for our house, we should take time to open up all the windows to equalize the pressure. Wrong again. Since tornado pressure cannot explode a house, opening the windows is useless.
Forget about the windows and just try to get to a safe place, the lowest level of the house, or if you don't have that, maybe into a bathtub covered by blankets or a mattress or something to protect your body from flying debris.
And finally, the most prevalent tornado myth of all, and many of us believe it for some reason, that maybe it's a metal construction or something, but anyway, that mobile home parks actually attract tornadoes. Wrong again. Brad Rippey says, yes, there may be more devastation, more death when a tornado hits a mobile home park, but
tornadoes move through single-family home areas just as often as they move through mobile parks, but your level of destruction is going to be much more significant. Even a 70 or 80 mile an hour wind can toss a mobile home on its side if it hits it right, whereas a house with a foundation will withstand that force.
And finally, here's something that's not a myth.
This is NOAA Weather Radio.
Having a NOAA Weather Radio with an alert function that turns on automatically when there's a severe weather warning has saved many people's lives, and yes, it could save yours. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
The iconic wildfire prevention symbol celebrates 80 years of service in 2024, but how can you write to him and give him an anniversary well wish? Rod Bain reports.
A category of rarefied air. Those individuals who have their own zip code within the United States. Any guesses who? The President of the United States.
The U.S. President has an individual zip code.
Shared with the First Lady, the 20500 zip code. Santa Claus? While mail to Santa goes to the town of North Pole, Alaska, zip code 99705, St. Nicholas himself does not have an individual zip code. Only one other individual can claim to have their own U.S. zip code.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
The symbol of wildfire prevention himself, Smokey Bear. According to U.S. Forest Service historian Lincoln Bramwell, while around since 1944 as an advertising campaign cartoon character, it was the rescue of a black bear cub from a New Mexico wildfire in 1950 that morphed the character into a living symbol, residing in the National Zoo in Washington, D.C.
That's when Smokey's popularity really sort of took off. A symbol you could visit and see with your own eyes if you visited the National Zoo in our nation's capital. From there, Smokey became so popular and started receiving fan mail, primarily from children, and whole classes would write Smokey, care of the National Zoo, that the U.S. Postal Service actually created Smokey's own zip code.
The living symbol Smokey died in 1976, succeeded by a cub adopted 5 years earlier, Little Smokey, who became the living symbol at the National Zoo until his passing in 1990. Smokey's zip code remained active until it was decommissioned in 1993. However, Smokey Bear's popularity with citizens remained so strong, letters continued to be sent via the zip code to the Wildfire Prevention Bear. That led to the Forest Service and the U.S. Postal Service reactivating Smokey's zip code in 2014, the 70th anniversary of Smokey's creation through the Joint Ad Council, Forest Service, National Association of State Foresters Public Service Campaign. And while there was an interruption of sorts in Smokey's mail, there has been no such disruption in Smokey presenting his message to the American public.
It's pretty incredible to think about 80 years of a continuous public service announcement campaign.
With 80th anniversary celebrations planned in various forms across the country in 2024. And if you are interested to write Smokey to wish him happy anniversary, Lincoln Bramwell, what is Smokey's zip code anyway?
20252.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. We'll be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Chuck Zimmerman has today's featured interview.
At the Modern Ag on the Mall event taking place here in Washington, D.C. I'm visiting with John Deere, and I have with me Aaron Wetzel. And Aaron, first of all, tell me what you do for Deere.
My job at Deere is the Vice President of Production and Precision Ag Production Systems, helping customers in the corn, soy, small grains, sugar, and cotton production systems bring value to them through the integration of technology with our machines, all to help improve yield, help improve productivity, and ultimately their bottom lines.
So we've got the general public coming through here, and there's also folks, you know, that are elected or maybe it's some of their aides. It's what kind of message do you have for those folks?
Yeah, what's exciting about this event here in Washington, D.C. is the diversity of participants that come and visit our booth here on the Mall. You know, we've got the general population who really don't understand agriculture. It gives us an opportunity to talk about agriculture, what we're doing across the globe to help feed the world. How our machines at Deere play a key role in helping produce the food fiber that we put on their tables every day. And I think they leave with a better understanding of what agriculture is all about. For policymakers, it's an opportunity for us at Deere to talk about the importance of technology for our customers to help them be more productive, to help them produce more with less, and do so that gives them a more economic benefit, but also is an impact to our environment. So, you know, depending on the participant that comes in the door, we've got a great message for all of them.
So this event's put it together by the ag sector of AEM. What do you think about the whole concept for this?
Well, I think the concept of the event, you know, talking about agriculture, talking about modern agriculture and what we're doing with technologies, I think is a great opportunity for us to have a voice to key decision makers here on the Hill, talk to them about what the challenges our customers face and how we as an industry can come together to bring solutions for them to improve their operations and help produce the food we need for the world.
Well, you've got a great display here of some of your equipment. Tell me a little bit about what's new with John Deere this year and in the area that you oversee.
Yeah. You know, it's exciting this year. We've got a lot of great new products really focused on creating new value for customers. You know, in each of our product programs, we start with the customer and understanding their needs, their opportunities, and how our products and technology can help create that value for them. So here in our display booth today, we've got several examples of that understanding deeply the needs of our customers and bringing to them new levels of technology and capabilities that improve their operations, give them more productivity, and ultimately can improve yield. Some examples would be our sprayer platform, for example, where we have a brand new sprayer. Included with that sprayer is a new concept called See and Spray, which incorporates high-definition cameras, high-speed computing capabilities, as well as artificial intelligence that is determining between weeds and plants on what should be applied with chemicals or not, and we're only applying those herbicides to the weeds themselves. That's saving the growers nearly 70% in chemical costs, and it's helping them from the bottom line perspective, but it's helping our environment by placing less chemicals on the field. So that is available for our customers today in market. We have examples of autonomous operations. So we have a joint venture with Gus Automation that allows us to bring a fully autonomous blast sprayer into the marketplace, and that's changing the game for tree farms, predominantly almonds or fruit trees, to allow them to address the need for a labor shortage that exists primarily in that part of the world. And so we've seen great feedback and results from that particular investment we've made with Gus Automation. We have an example for our large farm operations is the 8R tractor with our full autonomy package. So we're excited about the future that autonomy brings to address, again, that labor shortage that we see in many parts of America in terms of labor availability and capabilities. And with this autonomy solution, primarily focused for tillage at our first foray into this, we're going to bring that capability to our customers across the tillage step. And so that's available for customers today. We have behind me the new S7 series harvesting solutions that is an exciting upgrade to our existing combine platform. It brings a new level of automation and capability. So I talked about our See and Spray, a Sense and Act, where we're using cameras and computing capabilities. We have that same system on this harvesting solution that is actually looking ahead of the combine, looking at the density of the crop coming into the machine and automatically adjusting the speed of the combine and the settings of the combine to optimize the performance and output. And so that's a new feature that we just launched a few months ago and we'll have available next year for our customers. But an example of how we're working closely with customers, understanding the challenges that they have, and how we can bring together technology and equipment to help unlock new value for them.
How about when it comes to the data part of this, which is so critical? Can you talk a little bit about how farmers are able to give you that information and feel safe about that? And maybe talk a little bit about interoperability, which is a key word to another organization, Ag Gateway, you're probably familiar with. Just a little bit about that.
Okay. We've made significant investments over several years, over a decade probably, in our digital solutions to help customers better manage their operations. So you heard me talk about all of the machines that we have here, but all of these machines are also connected to the cloud and are capturing data around the machine performance itself, but also the job that it's doing and the agronomic impact of those steps in through the course of the growing season, from planting to crop protection to the harvest solution, the tillage solution even. So we're bringing all of that information into one location called the John Deere Operations Center that allows customers to better manage their farms, to see holistically how their machines are operating, how the fields are performing, and then make adjustments and changes going into the next growing season. And we find that our customers see this tool as extremely powerful them, A, to be able to manage machines from a remote location, but more importantly, make those key decisions they need to make year over year. The data and the connectivity is mission critical for that, and we've invested heavily in the connectivity solutions for our customers. Historically, we've relied on cellular connectivity, and we realize that in many geographies, cellular coverage does not exist. So we recently this year announced a partnership with Starlink that gives us satellite connectivity, really opening up the capabilities for our customers to take more advantage of these precision tools that require connectivity to perform at its best. Within the John Deere Operations Center, that data is our customers' data. They choose who they share that data with, and we ensure that they opt in for those opportunities to share with their trusted partners and advisors. But more importantly, the Operations Center is that central repository for them to manage their operations holistically. We want as much data as possible, and we have interoperability of data with many other partners across the industry. And also for customers who have a mixed machine fleet, they can bring that data up into the operations center through our connectivity capabilities. So we're looking at the customers and what they need to manage their operations and giving them the tools to connect their fleet and help them manage more effectively.
Well, I think that non-ag folks kind of think we're behind when it comes to technology, but you've done a great job, especially with the consumer show, to show people that, yeah, we actually are doing some pretty cool things.
It's interesting that you asked that question because I've worked in agriculture now 35 years, and it's interesting to see how our industry, I think, on many fronts is leading and leading in front of a lot of other sectors. And I would even challenge automotive in terms of automation and autonomy. So if we look at the computing capabilities we have with the See and Spray solution, the artificial intelligence utilization that we have here, no one's doing that across other industries to the level that we are to helping growers produce more food. The investments we're making in fully autonomous vehicles, we're actually running in the fields today fully autonomously. There aren't many companies that can say they can do that. So I feel like agriculture is the unsung hero in terms of what we're doing and the investments that we're making. But it's in a very exciting time, and I've been proud to be a part of that industry, to see how it's evolved so rapidly over the past 5 years, and really exciting for what the future brings, because this pace of change that's coming, fueled by these technologies that we're incorporating and utilizing, it's only going to get even faster. And so the future is bright for agriculture, and the future is bright for our customers and how they engage with technology, but more importantly, how they are able to produce more and do with less.
Well, before we close, anything else you might want folks to know about what Deere's doing or this event that we didn't touch on?
You know, I think at the end of the day, Deere is all about serving our customers. We want to build deeper, stronger relationships with our customers in every aspect of their business. We are making investments heavily into the capabilities of our products, new technologies to help create new value for them. And we want to be partnered with them for the future to help them produce the food that we need to feed this growing population by 2050 of 10 billion people. They're not going to be able to do it by themselves. Neither are we. So how we can partner to make that happen is important.
Thank you very much, Aaron, for visiting with me here from Washington, D.C. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
You're listening to the AgVet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. The last April U.S. drought monitor reveals not only a contracting of total drought coverage and area drought, but also less drought coverage where various crops and commodities are raised. Rod Bain reports.
Continued improvement in overall U.S. drought coverage to the point.
Whether you look at drought or the D3 and D4 coverage, those numbers on April 30th are the lowest that we have seen in approximately 4 years.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says for the U.S. drought monitor for the period ending April 30th.
By April 30th, that number had dipped just below 17%. The exact number in the lower 48 states, 16.96%.
While for the extreme to exceptional drought categories,
we see April 30th coverage just 0.85%. That is down from about 1.2% at the beginning of April.
He adds there are some potential trouble spots regarding increasing drought coverage, such as parts of the central and southern plains. That is reflected in one of the few commodities seeing a month-over-month increase in drought coverage area, winter wheat.
The current drought coverage for the U.S. winter wheat production area is 28%. That is up from 18% at the beginning of April, and also up from a recent minimum of just 12% back in March of 2024. And that does reflect some of the trouble spots that we see across eastern Colorado, Kansas, and into parts of Oklahoma and Texas, just happening to overlap with some of our key winter wheat production areas.
Mostly positive indicators are observed for spring planted crops and commodities in drought. One exception, though.
As we move to the north, a few issues in some of our spring wheat and other northern crop production areas. 27% of the U.S. spring wheat production area in drought at the end of April, up slightly from 25% in early April.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.